One of the world's greatest libraries, the secret deals that almost destroyed it, and the grassroots campaign that rescued it.
The New York Public Library is one of the world's five or six greatest libraries. It has rare manuscripts by Beethoven, by Walt Whitman, by James Joyce. It has Virginia Woolf's Cain. It has George Washington's Recipe for Beer, as well as millions and millions of other items.
That's Nation correspondent Scott Sherman. His book is Patience and Fortitude: Power, Real Estate, and the Fight to Save a Public Library. Then we air an excerpt from our 2014 interview with Eric Alterman about his book, Inequality in One City, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour here at this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The giant stone lions that stand sentinel outside the main branch of the New York Public Library are legendary. Patience and Fortitude, as they're named, are an apt description of the years-long campaign it took to rescue the library from an ill-conceived plan to gut its storied reading room and demolish its stacks. The plan, backed by the administration of Mayor Michael Bloomberg and pushed by some of the city's most powerful billionaires and real estate tycoons, would have cost the cash-strapped library some $500 million and eviscerated its research function. I first learned of the plan in late 2011 as I mounted the steps of the storied institution with my granddaughter. I wanted to show her the wonderful murals in the hallways and the grand soaring space of the Rose Reading Room. On our way in, we were accosted by a young man with a petition he wanted us to sign. After learning of the peril the library was in, we duly signed, and I came away with a sticker exhorting in large letters to save the NYPL. The sticker still adorns the cover of my laptop, but against all odds, the fight it refers to was largely won by a coalition of famous writers, academics, and citizens' groups. A national treasure was saved, albeit not without some grievous wounds. My guest, Scott Sherman, recounts this David and Goliath story in his book, Patience and Fortitude: Power, Real Estate, and the Fight to Save a Public Library. It is at once a hugely readable history of the library's secret plans and a stirring account of a rare triumph against the forces of money and power. Scott Sherman is a contributing writer of The Nation and also wrote for Lingua Franca. His work has appeared in Vanity Fair, the London Review of Books, and the Washington Post, among other venues. Patience and Fortitude was published by Melville House in June. I started out by asking Sherman to talk about the role of the NYPL in the cultural life of the city.
It's a palace of free education. The New York Public Library is a place where anyone could walk in off the street and access millions of books, pamphlets, pieces of art, completely for free. All you need is a library card. And at the same time, you can walk up to the third floor reading room, the Rose Reading Room, and access one of the most exquisite public spaces in New York. If you're there to do research, you can use a very skilled and professional staff, albeit one that is shrinking, but you can also use the 42nd Street Library and the entire NYPL system, for that matter, as a place to take refuge from the rain and the snow. There are people in the Rose Reading Room at 42nd Street who are doing their Christmas cards and their taxes. It's simply one of the great inclusive spaces in New York City.
Have you spent a lot of time there yourself?
I started using the library in the early 1990s. I was a freelance writer, and I specialized in long-form magazine pieces that sometimes took 8 weeks to do, and I needed access to a research library. I could not access Columbia or NYU because I didn't have connections to those two great universities. So the New York Public Library became sort of my home office, my home away from home, and a place where I was able to do very serious scholarly research on a range of topics pertaining to my freelance writing.
So tell us about the library's founding.
It was founded in the 1890s. At the time, New York City had a very jumbled, poorly organized library system. There were some struggling branch libraries in the Lower East Side, for example. There were a number of libraries for basically rich gentlemen. There were also a number of libraries run by the Catholic Church. And a handful of highly intelligent people decided to fuse these three library systems into one library system, the New York Public Library, which is separate from the Brooklyn Public Library and the Queens Public Library.
There used to be a reservoir there. That must have been something to take out. Tell us about the building of the library. It was very innovative.
The New York Public Library was basically the work of John Shaw Billings. He was a Civil War veteran. He had been a surgeon during the Civil War. He was an expert in hospital construction, in sanitary engineering. He's been called the most skilled and talented librarian in the entire history of the United States. And it was Billings' idea to build the library on 42nd Street on top of the old Croton Reservoir. And it was Billings who hired the two brilliant architects, Crerar and Hastings, who built the building from roughly 1895 until 1911.
So talk about this. I mean, the design of this building, what was so extraordinary about it?
There was an effort backed by city leaders to create one of the most beautiful public libraries in the country, which they succeeded in doing. It was also an attempt to create a very functional space. So perhaps Billings' most important innovation, which was a radical innovation at the time, was to build on the third floor of the 42nd Street Library a reading room, which is now called the Rose Reading Room. It's two city blocks long. And when it was built in 1911, it was controversial because at that time, great reading rooms did not exist on the third floor of buildings. There were many people who felt that the reading room should be on the ground floor, but Billings insisted that it be on the top floor of the building so users would be away from the chaos of the streets, and he wanted to make sure the room was also flooded with light.
Mm. And it is held up by the famous stacks. Describe those stacks. Describe how, you know, what role they play both structurally and functionally in the library.
Under the Rose Reading Room at the 42nd Street Library are seven levels of iron and steel book stacks designed by Crerar and Hastings. It's a dense hive of 96,000 shelves. And until recently, those stacks held 3 million books. It's a remarkably innovative system for book storage and delivery. The way it worked for a century, from 1911 until roughly 2 years ago, was this. You would enter the library and fill out a call slip requesting a book. The call slip would go down into the stacks where young people would run around and get the book. The book would be put into a small elevator, and the elevator would bring it up to the Rose Reading Room where patrons could use it. So it's a remarkably innovative system for book storage and delivery. And when the stacks were unveiled in 1911, the quality of those stacks were seen as a marvel of early 20th century American engineering.
In fact, they were Carnegie steel, is that right?
Some of the stacks are Carnegie steel. I'm told that if you look down from stack 7 to stack 1, at the top of some of the columns, you can see the word Carnegie.
Mm. So this magnificent system, this book delivery system, delivered some extraordinary volumes over the years. The collection was really world class. Do you have an example that comes to mind of some of the holdings that were really extraordinary?
The New York Public Library is one of the world's five or six greatest libraries. It has rare manuscripts by Beethoven, by Walt Whitman, by James Joyce, It has Virginia Woolf's Cain. It has George Washington's recipe for beer, as well as millions and millions of other items.
Mm. The New York Public Library, I mean, we're focusing on the one that has the two lions, Patience and Fortitude, who form the title of your book, Patience and Fortitude, Power, Real Estate, and the Fight to Save a Public Library, Scott Sherman. But it's not just that, and you don't just talk about the NYPL, because it's really the NYPL at 42nd Street, but it's intimately linked to some to the branch libraries, some of which are pretty illustrious in themselves. I mean, tell us about the Schomburg Library.
Schomburg Library was the work of one man, Arturo Schomburg, who was a turn-of-the-century New York bibliophile and bookworm. He worked in a bank. He was born in Puerto Rico, but he worked in a New York City bank, and collecting and documenting black history was basically his life's work. He would spend almost all of his free time and his weekends haunting used bookshops, and he began to amass an incredible archive of material pertaining to African American history. And at some point, thanks to the largesse of the Carnegie Corporation, Schomburg's materials were transferred from his own library to what is now the Schomburg Library at 135th Street and Broadway in New York City.
And there was also another library very, very close to the one with the lions, and that's the Mid-Manhattan Reading Library. What is its name exactly?
It's called the Mid-Manhattan Library. It's directly across from the great building at 42nd Street and 5th Avenue. It was built in 1970 because there was an overflow crowd in the Rose Reading Room at 42nd Street, and simply there wasn't enough space to work. And so the New York Public Library Administration decided that they needed a space principally for high school students to study, but also a space where books can be checked out, because at the great building at 42nd and 5th Avenue, books cannot circulate. Well, actually, now they can circulate, but that's a footnote we'd have to discuss later. But the Mid-Manhattan Library went up in 1970, and it's a very decrepit building. It's been allowed to rot by city leaders and New York Public Library officials, but it was gorgeous when it opened in 1970, and it has enormous potential today.
Mm. And finally, the last library I thought would be nice to mention would be the Library of the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, which was also part of this system.
It opened in the mid-1960s. There were great hopes for it at the beginning. It had, at the start, a very skilled staff of trained librarians who, in many cases, had advanced degrees in music and in dance. And that library throughout the 1970s and 80s was a pretty remarkable outpost for research into the performing arts. In the 1990s, it started to decline, and when the New York Public Library controversy erupted in early 2012, one of the first newspaper commentaries about the controversy was written by the historian Edmund Morris, who writes a lot about dance and who had used the performing arts library a lot over the years. And in that New York Times piece, Morris said the building had become a dump. He talked about its deterioration. And I keep hearing from staff members that many of the skilled librarians and curators have simply been removed from that space. And now the performing arts library really has no staff or no skilled trained staff, so far as I'm told.
Before we began the interview, I told Scott Sherman that I had learned about the terrible cuts the Performing Arts Library had undergone when I'd contacted them about taking my mother's archives. She was a modern dancer and choreographer who was instrumental in the artistic renaissance of Soho in the 1970s.
And as I mentioned to you before we began this interview, my own mother's archives, I had contacted the Performing Arts Library and asked them if they wanted her stuff, and they said, well, they'd love to take it, but that really I should find another place because they had nobody who could process it. It would take years. So it has ended up in a private hands, basically, at NYU, the NYU Downtown Library, which I thought was sad because I thought it would have been so much better for it to be in a public space. So even though we call it the New York Public Library, it's not actually public in the way it is funded. Talk about the economics of the New York Public Library.
It's tricky. It's hard to explain to people. The system consists of four research libraries, of which the main building at 42nd Street and 5th Avenue is the crown jewel. There are three other research libraries, but there are also 88 branch libraries across New York City. And the 88 branch libraries are mostly funded by New York City tax revenue, mostly, whereas the four research libraries get very little government money. Those four research libraries, by and large, have to subsist on private money, which means philanthropic dollars, and that usually means money from very, very wealthy New Yorkers.
And it's had its troubles over the years financially, even before the 2008 crash. Maybe you could reference them a bit, but then talk about the impact of the 2008 financial crash.
The New York Public Library has always been financially troubled. There was a financial crisis in 1923 in which the library was in great danger. The crisis was ameliorated by several million dollars given by wealthy New York philanthropic families. There was another crisis in 1948. The 1960s were bad for NYPL, and the 1970s were a disaster. The system has always been financially challenged. In 2007, before the financial crisis, I should say, the trustees created behind closed doors a radical plan to sell three branch libraries that sat on prime real estate in Midtown Manhattan and to undertake a $300 million renovation of the main building at 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue. That renovation was to be undertaken by Lord Norman Foster, the British architect.
And what was the plan that was devised? It was called the Central Library Plan. That was that $300 million renovation. Although you say in your book, Scott Sherman, in Patience and Fortitude, that it actually probably, if it had gone through, would have topped out at about $500 million. How could they justify spending that kind of money when the system itself was in such shambles?
It was a Bloomberg-era project. Bloomberg is Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City. He wanted it to happen, and so the controversy was born in early 2012. There was a two-year controversy, at the end of which the Central Library Plan died 4 months after Bill de Blasio took office. And yes, after the plan died in May 2014, the New York Public Library admitted that it would have cost not $300 million, but $500 million. Now, that suggests I did not get interviews with Mayor Bloomberg or Mayor de Blasio, but it seems to be the case that the city green-lighted this project without asking NYPL for proper paperwork showing how much it would actually cost. As it happens, the plan cost, according to the New York Public Library, $18 million. That is to say, $18 million was wasted on this aborted plan. The architect, Lord Foster, was paid $9 million for a canceled architectural design. And since the New York Public Library trustees were eager to begin construction while Mayor Bloomberg was still in office, because it was a Bloomberg-era project, there was an effort beginning in early spring 2012 to remove the 3 million books from the stacks. This happened without the public being told anything about it. 1 year later, by spring 2013, the stacks were empty, and they remain empty. So after this controversial plan died, and it was a mixed victory, it was a partial victory for the critics. The critics saved the stacks. The Foster plan entailed destroying or demolishing the seven levels of book stacks, that dense hive holding 3 million books and containing 94,000 shelves. The critics also saved the Mid-Manhattan Library, which sat on prime real estate and which the trustees were very, very eager to sell. The reason I say it's a partial victory is because the stacks are empty, and it's not clear where those 3 million books are. I've asked NYPL again and again. They won't say where the books are. I think some of them are probably in the hands of a private storage company. Others of the books are almost certainly in the hands of an off-site storage facility in Princeton, New Jersey. But I've been talking to users who rely on that building, and they tell me that many books are missing. Staff members tell me that many other books were damaged. So in the hasty attempt to get the books out of the stacks, so demolition could begin while Bloomberg was in office, they've created a giant mess there.
Oh, that's really tragic. I mean, what's it like for a researcher to be there and ask for a book now?
It's become a very, very difficult place to do research, partly because the Rose Reading Room has been closed for a year and a half. This is not the library's fault. It's an old room. A piece of the ceiling fell. It was recently announced that the Rose Reading Room will be closed until 2017. And so you have researchers really struggling in the adjoining side rooms in very cramped spaces with limited internet access. And essentially, there's a very complex, messy process to find those 3 million books and deliver them to the users at 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue. But basically, users of that building are boiling with rage right now.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Scott Sherman about his book, Patience and Fortitude, Power, Real Estate, and the Fight to Save a Public Library, that public library being the New York Public Library. Now, what did the NYPL trustees want to put in place of the reading room and the stacks?
The plan was to gut the stacks, demolish the stacks, remove them, which would open up an enormous amount of space in the middle of the building. And the plan was to have Lord Foster, the British architect, create in that space a up-to-date, state-of-the-art, circulating and computer library. Those plans were unveiled by Lord Foster at a press conference in December 2012, and the plans were immediately excoriated by a range of architecture critics. But the plan behind the plan, you know, the thinking of the NYPL trustees was basically to, as Tony Marks, the New York Public Library president, put it to me in an interview, Mark said to me, the goal here is to replace books with people. And what clearly is driving New York Public Library's leaders is a very, very ill-defined populist mission that calls for getting as many bodies into that building as they can. They judge success not by the quality of the research and the learning there, but by the number of people they can stuff into that already crowded building.
And people who would be basically checking their email and maybe drinking lattes.
I don't want to simplify that, Francesca. I mean, there's a trend in the library world right now from, you know, all over the United States to make libraries community spaces. There's a feeling in the library world that if nonprofit organizations are looking for a place to meet, they should go to the local library. There's a feeling that if high school students want to learn documentary filmmaking, they should do it at the library. There's a place for that. And if that's where librarians from around the country think their libraries ought to go, fine. The point I wish to make is that the New York Public Library is not any old library. It's one of the world's four or five great research libraries. And the trustees behind closed doors made a unilateral decision to basically gut the research function of that building, to demolish the stacks in the heart of that building. And all of this was done without a single public meeting and completely in secrecy.
And also there was some question as to whether demolishing the stacks would actually compromise the structural integrity of the building itself.
The controversy around the New York Public Library Central Library plan began in the spring of 2012. In December 2012, perhaps the country's most distinguished architecture critic, Ada Louise Huxtable, who wrote for the Wall Street Journal, wrote a blistering piece for the journal, which turned out to be her last piece. She died a couple of weeks later, completely demolishing the rationale for the Central Library plan. And one of the points that she made in that Wall Street Journal piece, which was called Undertaking Its Destruction, that was the headline, one of the points Huxtable made was that the 7 levels of stacks with her 96,000 shelves for books hold up the Rose Reading Room. And after the controversy broke in 2013, one of the New York Public Library's own engineers, not the architect, Norman Foster, but the engineer, admitted in that newspaper piece that it would be extremely risky to remove the stacks, which could damage the Rose Reading Room. So clearly the trustees didn't do enough thinking and research into the very structure of that great building.
So this is all very puzzling in a way, because if there's a chance at, you know, even just structural destruction of the building, why did the trustees put up such a fight once the critics began to make their points? And I guess I'm really asking, what was the kind of ideology, what were the kinds of interests, the kinds of connections? I mean, you say this is a power, real estate, and the fight to save a public library. What were the forces behind pushing this plan, and why were they so tenacious about it?
One expert on the nonprofit sector told me that when trustees at major nonprofit institutions make up their mind about something, they almost never reverse themselves. According to what this expert told me, there's a kind of momentum that takes place, which is very difficult to reverse. Another way of putting it is that these are the richest and most powerful people in New York City, and they don't like to be told what to do.
And one of those rich and powerful people was rich and powerful indeed. That was Stephen Schwartzman. Tell us about him and his role in this whole Central Public Library plan.
Before I go into Schwartzman, I just want to say that libraries around the country are changing in the digital age. They need to change in the digital age. When the controversy erupted in early 2012, the New York Public Library's officials gave as a justification for the Central Library Plan the fact that libraries need to change in the digital age. However, I was able to access 10 years of the trustee meeting minutes under the Open Meetings Law of New York State. And the minutes, and this goes to your question about why they did this, printed minutes of the trustee meetings over 10 years preceding the plan say very little about the need to bring the library into the digital age. The trustee meeting minutes say a lot about rising real estate prices in New York City. And the minutes talk a lot about how NYPL's land is increasingly valuable. So you asked me a minute ago why they did this. The main reason they did it was because they could, because they owned valuable real estate. And the people running the Board of Trustees were, by and large, real estate, or the most powerful people on the Board of Trustees were, by and large, real estate developers. So the real estate developers on the Board of Trustees did what comes naturally to them. They sold real estate.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the real estate deals that did go through was on the land of the Donnelly Library, which is opposite the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. It sounds like the NYPL gave away the store, and I guess that they sold it for something, you say, like $59 million, and then there was a penthouse that was for sale in the building that was built afterwards that alone went for $60 million.
It's a complicated part of the story. Let me explain it as succinctly as I can by saying that the first order of business for the Central Library Plan, which was passed in June of 2007, was to sell the Donnell Library across from the Museum of Modern Art. It was a beloved branch library that generations of New Yorkers had used. It was an extremely valuable piece of property. So it was sold in complete secrecy in late 2007. Users were never told. They simply showed up one day and there was a sign on the door saying this library is closed. But the person they sold it to went broke after the 2008 recession. So the building has been transferred to a new owner, but it's still empty. And it is now a luxury high-rise containing condos and a hotel. And the penthouse in that luxury high-rise, which again was the old Donnell Library, is on the market for $60 million. The New York Public Library was paid $59 million for the entire property. So the penthouse is selling for $60 million. The library received $59 million for the entire property, which has led some people to wonder if it was radically undersold.
So this was done in total secrecy. And I just wonder if you could weigh in on how an institution that is of such importance to the people of New York, to the communities that it serves, can operate in such secrecy.
I work for The Nation magazine. One of my beats at The Nation is philanthropy and the nonprofit sector. And I've noticed in the last 10 years that it's gotten much harder to report on foundations and nonprofit organizations. The communications departments in these organizations are much more aggressive, and they're usually staffed these days by lawyers. And so I've seen a tightening of the entire nonprofit philanthropic sector as the entire country, I'm afraid, has gotten, in some cases, more conservative in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And so the NYPL Central Library Plan, it was born in secrecy because the trustees never felt the need to open up the process. The president of the library at the time, Paul LeClaire, was not known for being an inclusive president of the library. His staff did not feel like he was particularly interested in their concerns. And it was a secretive process also because two major management consulting firms were involved in the gestation of the Central Library Plan. One of them was McKinsey & Company, and the other was Booz Allen Hamilton. And according to the trustee meeting minutes that I was able to look at, Booz Allen Hamilton suggested to the trustees in the weeks before the plan was finalized in June 2007 that it be kept secret. So the trustees simply listened to their management company, which insisted on secrecy.
And in fact, you had quite a bit of trouble getting people to talk with you about this. I mean, it must have been a frustrating process.
I don't want to complain because lots of journalists have problems getting sources to speak with him. I'm not unique about that. But yeah, I was very, very surprised by how closed New York Public Library is. I was given very limited access to the library's president, Tony Marks. He gave me 2 hours of his time in 2011. He gave me 1 hour of his time in 2012 and nothing in 2013, 2014, and 2015. Of the library's 62 trustees, only one trustee, Professor Robert Darnton of Harvard University, a specialist on French history. Darnton was really the only trustee to stay in regular contact with me, and every time we spoke, he emphasized that he couldn't tell the full story because the trustees had already agreed that Tony Marks, the president, would speak to the public, but Tony Marks was saying very little. So yes, I was extremely surprised at how closed the place was.
Scott Sherman. We'll talk more about his book, Patience and Fortitude, after the break, and learn how the New York Public Library was saved. You can listen to Writer's Voice anytime at writersvoice.net, or by subscribing to our free podcast, or get our free weekly newsletter delivered straight to your inbox. That was Check It Out, a Taylor Swift parody by the Topeka, Kansas Library. Welcome back to Writer's Voice on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with journalist Scott Sherman about his book, Patience and Fortitude. It's about the grassroots fight to save the New York Public Library from a disastrous plan pushed by some of the most powerful interests in New York City and their allies. One of those allies was NYPL trustee and public intellectual Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Sherman, who reported on the plan for The Nation magazine, found himself on the receiving end of a bizarre confrontation with Gates.
The NYPL trustees, it's a complicated group of people. It's not just business leaders like Stephen Schwartzman, who gave $100 million to the library in 2008. You asked me about Schwartzman before. The mastermind of the Central Library Plan, Francesca, was a real estate developer called Marshall Rose. He has been the single most important trustee at the library for 15 or 20 years now. There were also a number of artists and cultural figures and intellectuals on the board of trustees, one of whom is Henry Louis Gates, Jr., the esteemed Harvard University professor and commentator, and had a very strange encounter with Professor Gates in late 2013 when the trustees were having their quarterly meeting in front of the County Cullen Library, at the County Cullen Library on 136th Street in Harlem. I approached Professor Gates as he was entering the trustee meeting. I introduced myself as a reporter and I asked him for his thoughts on the Central Library plan. And he leaned over and whispered into my ear, quote, "You don't want any trouble, do you, guy?" End quote. And with that, he turned his back on me and with big smiles greeted his fellow trustees. I was surprised. Who would expect a Harvard professor to act that way?
A threat.
It's fair to say that.
So now let's talk about the opposition. You mentioned the architecture critic for the New York Times. Well, at this point, she was for the Wall Street Journal, Ada Louise Huxtable, who, as you say, died, I think, at the age of 91, just a few days after her article, an important article was published about this, her criticism. But then there was a professor at Princeton who became outraged, started something. Talk a little bit about the evolution of the opposition.
This is a New York story in the sense that many different people from New York decided to come together to defend this library. It was a mixture of retired librarians, historic preservationists, professors. You're referring to Professor Stanley Katz of Princeton University, who used the New York Public Library as a young graduate student and young professor in the 1950s and 60s. And when the library got in trouble in 2011, decades later, he came to its assistance, as did a colleague of his down the road, Professor Joan Scott, who teaches at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, which is separate from Princeton University. But like Stan Katz, Joan Scott had used the Rose Reading Room in the 42nd Street Library in the 1950s. And going there to research French history and being able to touch old newspapers that were published in Paris during the Revolution of 1848, that inspired her to pursue a career in French history. So when the library, when the controversy erupted in 2011, these two people, as well as many others, decided to donate a lot of their time to a political campaign that lasted 2 years, but which ultimately saved the library.
Yeah, it did. And I remember myself just a couple of years ago going up to show my granddaughter the library. We did go up into the reading room. And on our way in, we ran into a bearded young man who was handing out petitions, and we gave him some money, and I even think my granddaughter signed the petition. So this became a popular struggle as well. It was not just academics, but it began to draw in a larger section, a younger contingent that was quite crucial in the success of the campaign.
For the first year and a half, this was an effort waged by about 25 people, mostly over the age of 60. As the campaign began to heat up in late 2013, some younger people did get involved. A professor at Columbia University who teaches literary translation, Susan Bernofsky, brought her social media skills to the campaign and became very effective on Twitter and Facebook. A professional New York City organizer, a kind of lifelong political activist called Leslie Kaufman, she got involved towards the end and brought a tremendously sophisticated sense of theatrical activist politics to the fight. And so after a year and a half in which the core group of 25 people was pretty exhausted, they were lucky to get some aid at the end of the campaign by some pretty skilled, younger, energetic activists. And I should also say that a number of well-known writers came to the library's assistance at the end. E.L. Doctorow, the great novelist, issued a very astringent statement at the height of the controversy, saying that the Central Library plan was, quote, an act of manic mutilation, end quote. The artist Art Spiegelman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Mouse, wrote a devastating piece of art featuring one of the library's lions, Patience, who was mutilated by a wolf, the wolf signifying the Wall Street presence on the Board of Trustees. So it was a broad coalition of library lovers, historic preservationists, students, intellectuals, etc.
But even that campaign, and they had a huge mountain to tackle. What finally did kill the plan?
To my great disappointment, I never got an interview with Mayor de Blasio, but political insiders told me that de Blasio didn't like the Central Library plan of the New York Public Library and basically insisted that they not go ahead with it. There's no smoking gun document to that effect. As I said, de Blasio did not give me an interview. Mayor de Blasio's press secretary would not speak with me. But elected officials on the inside who know the way this mayoral administration works told me that de Blasio, who had opposed the plan as a mayoral candidate, signaled to NYPL 5 months after taking office that they couldn't proceed with it.
And there was some money involved because they had been promised $150 million.
Mayor Bloomberg had allocated, that is to say, promised $150 million, and the de Blasio administration, after getting elected, had to decide what to do with that money. I don't know what happened to that money because de Blasio's people won't tell me, but we know for sure that it was not given to NYPL for the purposes they wanted it for, which was to demolish the stacks and to do a major reconstruction of the 42nd Street Library. I should say that after the plan died, we touched on this earlier, it's worth repeating, the library announced it would have been a $500 million project. So for 2 years, they sold it as a $300 million project. After it died, we learned it might have cost $500 million. The reason this is important is because library staff members tell me that such a massive renovation, $500 million, might well have bankrupted the NYPL. It's a very fragile institution, financially and physically. They have a very difficult time even keeping soap and toilet paper in the bathrooms of the 88 branch libraries. It's fair to say that the trustees put the entire institution at risk.
So what are the lessons, the most important lessons that you would like people to take away from this?
The lesson, I think, lessons are that, A, libraries and museums should not rush to sell their real estate. They should proceed very, very slowly on that front. And secondly, B, libraries and museums should consult with their users and the public before undertaking massive construction projects. Again, this Central Library plan of the New York Public Library was created in secrecy. The library never sponsored a single public meeting to discuss it. If, you know, library democracy in the United States is not at all dead. In Seattle, the Seattle Public Library, in the late 1990s, the Seattle Public Library remade itself. There were some differences with the New York situation. In Seattle, it was a bond issue. But it was done in a remarkably democratic way. The Seattle City Librarian held over 100 meetings with the public. In New York, the New York Public Library trustees, again, did not sponsor a single public meeting. And the entire thing was really established behind closed doors.
Scott Sherman had another lesson he wishes he had more time to explore in the book, but didn't. He tells us now.
I wanted to write a short, fast book tightly focused on the New York Public Library, and one theme that I didn't have space to put in was the fact that the near destruction of the New York Public Library was sort of part of deeper trends in New York City under the Bloomberg administration. Under Bloomberg's leadership, almost everything in New York was for sale. There was a massive privatization surge throughout the five boroughs of the city, in which the power of money became ever more pronounced. And there was a feeling during the Bloomberg administration that everything is for sale, including the New York Public Library. And it was nearly destroyed because the trustees thought it was for sale.
And what is this process, what do you feel it is doing to New York City itself? Because, I mean, now we have a new mayor. We have de Blasio. Have the trends that started under Bloomberg just attained a life of their own? Is there a way to come back?
I would like to see Mayor de Blasio appoint a representative to the New York Public Library Board of Trustees. The mayor has an obligation to appoint a representative to the library's Board of Trustees. Mayor Bloomberg's representative was his sister, Marjorie Tiven. Mayor de Blasio has been in office for a year and a half. Inexplicably, he still has not installed a representative on the library's board, and a physical watchdog is really necessary and really needed there.
Well, it's a terrific story, and it's a terrific read as well. Scott Sherman, your book is Patience and Fortitude, Power, Real Estate, and the Fight to Save a Public Library. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure.
Nation correspondent Scott Sherman. You can find links for his reporting for The Nation on the New York Public Library at writersvoice.net. Next up, New York Mayor de Blasio's fight against inequality. We play an excerpt from my 2014 interview with journalist and author Eric Alterman. Stay tuned.
Read so hard, libraries trying to find me. They can't identify me. Checked in with a pseudonym, so I guess you could say I'm Mark Twaining. Read so hard, I'm not lazy. Go on Goodreads, so much rated. Fountainhead, I'm a just read. Gave it 4 stars and then changed it. Read so hard, I'm literary.
Goosebumps series, too scary.
Animal Farm, Jane Eyre. Barnes and Nobles, Foursquare. No TV, I read instead. Got lots of bills, but not bread. Burroughs, Golding, Shakespeare, all dead. Read so hard, got paper cuts. On trains while you're playing, connect the dots. All these blisters from turning pages. Read so hard, I'm seeing spots. Sudoku just can't compare. Nor Angry Birds, cause look at here. My little birds is getting stares. This print's rare.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There's a fight brewing over the soul of the Democratic Party. It's between the party's center-right establishment, typified by Hillary Clinton, and the party's progressive wing, represented by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, both of whom have made America's high and growing economic inequality the touchstone of their work. And while the centrists have begun paying lip service to concerns about inequality lately, it's too early to tell whether their record will match their rhetoric. One politician who does seem determined to align his record with his rhetoric is New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. It's been a little over a year since his election, and my guest, Eric Alterman, has a fascinating book out that looks at that record of year one. De Blasio ran on a platform of bringing more economic and social equality to the city's residents. Alterman says that to many people's surprise, including his own, de Blasio is on track to enact his platform, or at least a good chunk of it. His crowning achievement to date is the successful rollout of universal pre-K, despite New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's opposition to de Blasio's plan to make it permanently funded by a tax on the city's wealthiest residents. Cuomo nixed that tax and funded only 3 years of universal pre-K, but the de Blasio administration is confident that that is enough to ensure the program's long-term stability. But can de Blasio's progressive program outlast his administration, even if he does make real headway in correcting some of the worst impacts of inequality during it? And what does his approach, using the mechanisms of government itself to effect change, mean for the country at large? Those are some issues we take up in our conversation with Eric Alterman about his book, Inequality and One City. So let's talk about education. He has brought in universal pre-K to expand it to 50,000 students, four-year-olds, for 3 years. I have a quick question about that. For 3 years, that's the funding he got. He was not able to get a dedicated income stream by a minor, tax on millionaires to assure that universal pre-K would remain forever. So what happens at the end of 3 years?
Given how successfully the program was rolled out, I don't think it's possible to take it away. Mm-hmm. Personally, I think he always knew he was never going to get that tax. I thought it was symbolically important for him to say, I'm willing to tax rich people, because liberals have been afraid to say that. And this tiny little tax, I don't think it was ever going to happen, because Andrew Cuomo, his whole political persona is he doesn't want to tax rich people.
You know, there are so many things, as much as he can do with the city council, you point out in your book, Eric Alterman, in Inequality in One City, that there's a lot that de Blasio, the mayor, cannot do because the reins of power are in the state government. I mean, you pointed out ways in which he can achieve a redistributive program, because when we talk about inequality, we're talking about distribution of the wealth, basically. If Cuomo and state government are basically saying hands off on redistribution of the wealth, what are the forces that can help promote de Blasio's agenda on this? I mean, the Working Families Party, they were a huge impact on getting him elected, but they also went out for Cuomo against Zephyr Teachout, who had, been going against Cuomo. Well,
that was thanks to de Blasio that they did that. He negotiated that deal. Yeah. And I think it was probably the right thing to do from the standpoint of the best interest of the city. Now, look, Cuomo, he still needs to identify as a Democrat. And he still understands that inequality is the most important issue for Democrats. So he is willing to make compromises when he feels it's in their interest, in his interest. So, for instance, one compromise it seems like he's willing to make is to allow New York City to have a higher minimum wage than the rest of the state. It's not as high as de Blasio would like it. De Blasio would like to have the highest minimum wage in the whole country. But he's moved on that issue. De Blasio's focus on this has moved him on this issue. And he will move on other issues. He won't take a big bite out of the wealthiest people's incomes in the city, but he might take some small bites. Because very wealthy people understand that they've had a great ride for the past, since 2008, and they can afford a little bit of give. A good example we haven't talked about is housing policy. There's an enormous amount of money to be made in Manhattan and also in Brooklyn now in the housing market in New York City. You know, there's almost all the apartments being built now are $5 million or more. Mm-hmm. Apartments for $25 million are not even that rare. So under Michael Bloomberg, if you wanted a tax abatement under the 421 program, you had to build 80% affordable and 80% unaffordable. 80% whatever market rate, and 20% quote-unquote affordable. Affordable is defined as affordable to a person making between $35,000 and $100,000. So it sounds like a lot of money to people, but in New York, it's not a lot of money. Anyway, de Blasio, he hasn't put an actual figure on how much he wants to increase this by, but it looks like he's gunning for 27% rather than 20%, which is a big jump. It's a 33% jump in what you're demanding from the developers. So he's offering the developers the opportunity to make money in other ways, to make their buildings denser and taller, and to offer them certain services that they wouldn't otherwise get, and to be flexible about where the apartments are, actually. But he's and the point here is that the real estate industry is okay with all this because they're still making a fortune. And they understand that in order to keep things smooth, they've got to give a little more, and they are.
Bill de Blasio, Fiorello LaGuardia, the mayor of New York during the 1930s, during the previous Depression, is his model. Now, that was a time of great social movements. And it seems like we might be going into a time of social movements again. How do you see civil society being able to support de Blasio in his agenda going forward?
This is an area where I disagree with de Blasio. He would agree with you, and I don't. I think our movement in civil society is very weak. I think it's been particularly weakened under Bloomberg, who gave a lot of money to these organizations and made them dependent on that funding, and therefore unwilling to challenge him. And also, people are too busy trying to make a living, by and large. Most people, I don't think, are very political. New York's a little bit different than other places. It is a more political place, and we have a much bigger union presence than other places, so it's never going to quite go away. But I think he'd be crazy to depend on these organizations when to go up against the real estate industry, for instance. I mean, you saw there was a nascent movement about the cops, and then these guys got assassinated, and everybody said, okay, forget about that. We haven't got time to worry about that. We need to assure the safety of the cops. The cops were much, much stronger. Mm-hmm. And some of that will come back a little bit. But they can't really threaten the power of these organizations. Part of that is the problem of money in politics. You know, that the guys who pay for the campaigns are the people who call the tunes. Now, in New York City, we have a very good law, which is part of the reason de Blasio was able to get elected. With great matching law, I think it's 6-1, so that if you raise a certain amount, you can get 6 times as much back in funding, so that there's no great advantage to raising a lot of money, because there's a ceiling on that. It didn't work with Bloomberg. It doesn't work with a billionaire, but it works in a regular race like de Blasio was in. But I don't know. The Working Families Party, some of these organizations, they have some vibrancy to them, but I wouldn't bet on them as a means of power. Now, de Blasio, maybe because he has to say this, we argued about this, and he thinks that there's a historic movement that's never gone away, and it's coming back, and it'll be very inspirational. And, you know, if that were true, Barack Obama would be in a lot better shape than he is. I think people, you know, they've lost faith in politics, number one. And number two, money has strangled our ability to have popular pressure. Money is so much more powerful than people in our politics now that I'm just, a cynic about this. But so, I'd be happy to be proved wrong.
So do you feel that de Blasio basically is only going to be able to tinker around the edges because there is movement?
That's the wrong way to look at it. What de Blasio has going for him is not the movement. He's got the city government. Mm-hmm. City government is very big and powerful. Mm-hmm. According to one estimate I was given, it affects directly 20% of the incomes in New York City. So like I said, with the... with housing, he can say to developers, if you want to make all this money, you're going to have to cough up an additional 33% of your apartments for affordable housing. And they're doing it because they can't build without the permission of the city and the zoning laws and so forth. So he has all kinds of regulations and laws and lots of money, you know, billions of dollars to invest in order to make the city a fairer place. He can't end inequality. He maybe can't even make a dent in what's called the Gini coefficient, which is how you measure the distribution of wealth in a society. He probably can't do that. But he can give a lot of people the tools they need to pull themselves up in the world.
We're talking with journalist Eric Altman about his book, Inequality in One City, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment.
Well, one thing is affordable housing, and that's largely for the middle class, people who can't afford, you know, between, as you say, 30,000 and 100,000 a year, people who make that amount. But you also talk in the book about NYCHA, about New York City Housing Authority, which houses, an enormous number of people.
3 million people. But actually, I think a better example is the welfare agency. Mm-hmm. This is, the best symbol of the change between Bloomberg and de Blasio. Bloomberg appointed a guy to run that agency who is now moved on to the American Enterprise Institute, a right-wing think tank, whereas de Blasio appointed to head that agency the guy who was who had been, for the past 10 years, head of the Legal Aid Society, in charge of suing the city on behalf of the clients of the agency. And he'd worked there for 30 years. And this guy just went in and turned the whole place upside down and said, from now on, we're not serving ourselves, we're serving these people, and I'm changing all of these laws and regulations so that we can serve people who are getting assistance, who are the victims of domestic abuse, who are need drug treatment, et cetera, who need job training. And it's been a night and day change. And I'm so impressed by this because these people have no political power. They probably don't even vote. They certainly don't go to dinner parties with the editorial board of the New York Times. And yet people don't care in the administration. They're there. They've completely flipped the purpose of this agency. They've given them different marching orders. And they're not very politically astute marching orders, but they are consistent with the vision of reducing inequality in the city and helping the people who need help the most.
Eric Altman. His book is Inequality in One City, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment. Listen to our entire 2014 interview with him at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.